Thank you.
I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:39 p.m. on Monday, March 16th, 2026. Present today are Representative Stapp, Representative Bynum, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, and the three co-chairs, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lestefka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office with us. Please, before we start, mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear from the Department of Revenue as it presents its 2026 spring revenue forecast. Then we will hand over the gavel to hear SB 64 on elections, and if time permits, HB 280, apportion taxable income / digital business. With us today from the Department of Revenue is Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner, and Dan Stickle, Chief Economist. We've been joined by Representative Jimmy. Acting Commissioner Earls and Mr. Stickle, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation. And we've been joined by Representative Galvin.
Good afternoon. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. I am here today to support Chief Economist Dan Stickle in his presentation, but I'm sure that he will be able to answer all your questions.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, and thank you for the opportunity to present our spring revenue forecast. Slide two is the agenda for the presentation, so it's a little bit different layout than what we usually do for the spring forecast presentation. We will briefly walk through the unrestricted revenue forecast update and then have a number of slides that go into detail on oil price history, forecasting, and uncertainty, since that's really very apropos to the current situation around oil prices and global events. And several of the typical forecast presentation slides were moved to an appendix for this time around, and happy to go through those afterwards if desired. So slide three are the highlights of the changes that we made to the unrestricted revenue forecast for the spring forecast that was released last Friday. So for oil prices, we've increased our fiscal year 2026 projection by $9.77 per barrel to an average of $75.26 per barrel. And for fiscal year 27, we've increased our price forecast by $13 per barrel up to $75 per barrel. Looking at oil production, we have some slight increases to the production forecast there. The production forecast has been increased by 2,100 barrels per day for fiscal year 26 and by 700 barrels per day for fiscal year 2027. In terms of total unrestricted revenue, the increase to the revenue forecast was about $545 million for fiscal year 26 and about $510 million for fiscal year 2027, with the higher oil price forecast accounting for the majority of that increase, but not all of it.
Okay. Slide four.
Slide four provides some details on the fiscal year 2026 revenue forecast increase. I know there's been some questions around exactly how we got to that number. So as of the end of February, we were actually running $115 million ahead of forecast. And that was before accounting for any of the oil price activity that we've had here in March. And the primary reason for that higher forecast was actually due to corporate income tax collections on the non-petroleum side of things. We had some high one-time payments, as well as strength in the oil services and mining industry. And so we were looking at another $115 million as we went into this revenue forecast process. And then breaking out that $544.7 million forecast increase into its additional components. So $105 million of that was the additional non-petroleum corporate tax revenue. And as I just mentioned, that reflects collections that have already come in the door, primarily in December of 2026, a couple weeks after we put out our fall revenue forecast. About $370 million of the increased forecast is due to expected additional production tax and unrestricted royalty collections. And production tax in particular is very sensitive to oil price, as we expect more companies to be paying above the minimum tax floor. $20 million of the forecast increase is attributable to oil and gas corporate income tax based on the higher oil price forecast. About $30 million of the increase is attributable to the state's portion of the oil and gas property tax, primarily for the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And what's happened there is we assess the value of the pipeline system not every year. It's on a periodic basis. And in the time since the last full assessment of the pipeline system, the outlook for long-term production and therefore pipeline life has been extended, and costs have increased across the slope. And so therefore the replacement value has increased. So higher valuation of oil and gas property leading to that about $31 million property tax increase. And then the remaining $18 million of the forecast increase comes from other non-petroleum revenue sources, the two biggest being the mining industry based on higher gold and silver prices, and then some increased investment revenue from a little bit higher than expected earnings on the cash in the general fund.
I think we're going to wait on questions because even though a lot of it is appendices, the length of the slide deck. please continue, Chief Economist, and if you've got questions, please take note of them in the margins of your document. Please continue.
Sure. So slide five is a table showing our unrestricted revenue by major component for fiscal year 2025 and then the forecast for 26 and 27. So investment revenue, being the largest source of unrestricted revenue, contributed $3.8 billion in fiscal year 25, forecast at $3.9 billion for fiscal year 26 and $4.1 billion for fiscal year 27, with the largest component of the unrestricted investment being the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund that accounts for about two-thirds of unrestricted state revenue. Petroleum revenue generated $1.9 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal 25, and we're forecasting $1.8 billion in fiscal 26 and $1.9 billion in fiscal 27. And then lastly, non-petroleum sources contributed $639 million in fiscal 25, and we're forecasting that that will increase to about $740 million in fiscal 26 and about $760 million in fiscal 27. And so, again, in total, we had about $6.3 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal year 25, and we're forecasting $6.5 billion for fiscal 26 and $6.7 billion for fiscal 27.
Okay.
And so the next set of slides, I have several slides that go into oil prices. That has really been the story of the oil of the revenue forecast this go-around as we've been pulling numbers together for the last couple of weeks. So slide six shows our spring forecast for oil prices compared to the prior fall 2025 forecast. And then in the dotted line, we showed an alternative here, which is what the forecast would have looked like had we produced it in the middle of February. So as you can see, oil prices were trending up a little bit in February, but the spike in oil prices with the conflict in the Middle East has really caused a significant increase to the near-term price forecast from what's happened over the last couple of weeks. So our price forecast is based on the futures market for as many years as are available, which is through fiscal year 2033, and then we apply an inflation assumption thereafter. Futures market provides a timely and, importantly, a transparent price forecast. So we were able to generate this forecast last Wednesday at close of business on March 11th, and then turn around and crunch the numbers on the 12th and release the forecast on March 13th.
Okay, slide seven.
Slide seven. So price history and volatility, really one of the big stories of this revenue forecast. And this slide shows a history of what's happened with Alaska North Slope oil prices since the beginning of 2020. The average price has been about $74 per barrel over that time period, but the prices have been anything but stable. So we started calendar year 2020 around $70 per barrel and fell very quickly through the first several months of the year. Actually, prices went negative for a day in April of 2020 as there was significant oversupply due to the COVID pandemic. Prices recovered from there over the next couple of years. And then at the beginning of the war, when Russia invaded Ukraine, a little less than 2 years after we had a negative oil price, prices topped out at over $125 per barrel. Since the market has kind of digested the Russia-Ukraine situation, we returned again to close to that $70 average, and we've generally been in a kind of a stable to slightly downward trending oil price through 23 through 25. Oil prices started calendar year 2026 in the low 60s, and were kind of trending upwards through January and February as some of this Middle East issues were bubbling under the surface. And then at the beginning of March is when the Iran conflict started in earnest. Prices really went through the roof and peaked at over $100 per barrel last week.
Okay, slide 8.
Slide 8 shows an index of oil volatility. And this kind of puts a quantitative perspective on what we all know anecdotally, which is that there's a lot of uncertainty in the oil market right now. And so what this oil volatility index does is it uses the options market and prices for options on crude oil futures to come up with a level of uncertainty around potential future prices based on options prices. The exact numbers for the index are less important. What the key takeaway here is that high numbers mean high uncertainty and a high range for expected future prices. Low numbers mean less uncertainty and more stability expected in terms of future prices.
Okay.
The highest level of oil volatility on record since this index debuted in 2007 was during the COVID pandemic. Aside from that point in time, this current Iran conflict is the second highest level of uncertainty in the oil market. The level of uncertainty is even higher than when Russia invaded Ukraine, and it's higher than the peaks of the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. So this just, again, kind of puts in a quantitative perspective what we understand, which is that there's a lot of uncertainty right now.
Okay. Slide 9.
And slide 9 translates that uncertainty into dollar values. So what we've done here is we've taken our official spring 2026 revenue forecast, which again is based on the futures market, and we've used prices for crude oil options to derive different percentiles of potential oil prices. And what we can see here is that looking just a few months out to May of 2026, there's according to the markets for commodities, there's a 10% chance that oil prices will be well over $200 per barrel, and there's a 10% chance that oil prices will fall to $30 per barrel. And that's just looking 2 months out at the range of uncertainty. And so our price forecast for that month is around $90 per barrel, but a lot of uncertainty around that number. Looking at fiscal year 25, the upcoming budget year, the 10% range for the entire fiscal year is 45% on the downside and $45 on the downside and $130 on the upside. So again, a very wide range around our fiscal year 27 forecast of $75 per barrel.
All right, slide 10.
Slide 10 shows how the unrestricted revenue for fiscal year 26 could change with different oil prices. So oil prices averaged $67.34 through the end of February. Our forecast for the remainder of the fiscal year is an average of $91.09 per barrel. And that would get us to a total of $6.5 billion of unrestricted revenue for fiscal year 2026. Near the forecast price, a $1 increase or decrease in oil price just for the remaining 4 months of the year is a $15 million change in unrestricted general fund revenue. And for this chart, we included the 10% probabilities on the high and the low side for the remainder of the year, just to illustrate, depending, you know, so if we look at those 10% probabilities, 10% chance we end up with less than $6 billion for the fiscal year, 10% chance we end up with more than $7.5 billion just based on oil price just for these last 4 months of the fiscal year. So again, a lot of uncertainty around that $6.5 billion official forecast.
Okay. Slide 11.
Slide 11 shows the monthly values behind our ANS price forecast for fiscal year 2026. So prices ranged between $62 and $73 on a monthly basis for the first 8 months of the fiscal year, averaging out to that $67.34. For the remainder of the fiscal year, we're forecasting oil prices a little over $92 per barrel on average for March, April, and May, and then falling to a little over $87 per barrel for June, giving us the average for the last 4 months of the fiscal year of $91.09. Most recent closing price for Alaska oil was over $100 per barrel, so over the last couple of days at least, we're actually a little bit above our forecast so far.
Slide 12.
Slide 12 is a unrestricted revenue sensitivity table for fiscal year 2027. Again, we start with our official forecast of $75 per barrel, bringing in $6.7 billion of revenue. Around that forecast price, each $1 increase or decrease in oil price results in about a $40 million change to unrestricted revenue. That's a little bit higher than the heuristic from the prior fall forecast, just given where we are for production tax purposes in particular. With the higher price, we're expecting more companies to be paying above the minimum tax floor, and so the change in revenue per dollar of price is a little bit higher. And again, for fiscal year 2027, we included our 10% probability lines on this to illustrate the potential range of revenues. So about a 10% chance that we have less than $6 billion of revenue for the fiscal year, and a 10% chance that we have about $9.5 billion of revenue for the fiscal year. And so $3.5 billion range just based on oil prices alone for fiscal year 2027, and a 1 in 5 chance that we end up outside that range, really illustrating the uncertainty in the market right now.
Great. Slide 12.
Slide 12 shows our total unrestricted revenue since 2020, as well as our spring forecast and the prior fall forecast. So we were receiving about $7 billion of total unrestricted revenue in fiscal year 22 and 23. We're expected to reach those levels again, not until around fiscal year 2030. The forecast in the spring is up for all years in the forecast, but the most pronounced increases to the forecast really are this year and next year, with more modest increases in the later years.
Slide 14.
So slide 14 and then the following slide move away from the oil-specific discussion and touch on some other important concepts. So slide 14 is the estimated transfer from the permanent fund to the general fund for fiscal year 26 through fiscal year 36. The transfer is estimated to be a little over $3.8 billion in fiscal year 26 and then increasing steadily to about $5.3 billion by the end of the 10-year forecast period. Which is really remaining fairly stable in real terms if you back out inflation at around $3.8 billion per year. The permanent fund transfer forecast is based on a 7.3% annual return for the fund, and the percent of market value calculation is based on 5% of the average ending market value of the first five of the last six fiscal years. So the effective transfer is a little less than that headline 5%.
Okay. Slide 15.
Slide 15 has some information around our mining revenue forecast. And prior to the price action in oil for March, this was actually going to be kind of the big story of the spring revenue forecast. Minerals prices have really soared this year. We have had record gold and silver prices, gold over $5,000 per ounce, silver over $100 per ounce, and strength in other metals too, like zinc and lead and copper. This has been really a benefit to all of the existing mines in the state and the mining industry, and also helps make any proposed new mines look more attractive. We are now forecasting over $200 million of revenue from the mining industry in fiscal year 2027. That includes $189 million of unrestricted revenue, up from a little over $75 million in fiscal year 2025. About $100 million of that mining revenue forecast is due to mining license tax. That's the state's severance tax on mining. We're expecting nearly $80 million of corporate income tax from mining companies and over $30 million of state royalty from mining, which is split between unrestricted revenues, permanent fund, public school trust fund, and program receipts to the Department of Natural Resources. Slide 16 is just a kind of a conclusion slide for the information I've presented here. So again, we're forecasting a little over $500 million of additional revenue for both fiscal year 26 and fiscal year 27, based on the most likely outlook for high oil prices at this time. Those high oil prices are expected to be temporary, and there's an extreme amount of uncertainty around those price forecasts, as I mentioned earlier. So revenue probably won't come in exactly as we forecasted it for fiscal 26 and 27. But to highlight the permanent fund POMV methodology, a percent of market value, provides a stable kind of foundation for the revenue forecast. That's 2/3 of the unrestricted revenue. And we know that with certainty for fiscal 26 and 27. And so the uncertainty around oil prices is layered on top of that. And that concludes the main part of the presentation. I do have numerous appendix slides. I'd be happy to leave with the walk through or take questions.
Mr. Stickle, my committee has been very patient, and I appreciate their allowing you to move through that. I do have quite a few questions, but I want to defer to them with one exception. The war in Iran began on or about February 28th is what I'm seeing. And when would a boost in severance tax revenue enter the Treasury?
Sure, Chair Josephson. So the boost to severance tax and royalty revenue would likely be for the March production month. Those returns and payments would be due at the end of April. So it'd be end of April that we would see those returns for the March production month. We do have an accrual for production tax and royalties. So March through June production months will all be part of fiscal year 2026. But again, those are due at the end of the following month.
Well, let me follow up on a logical question. So it sounds like June payments would come in like August. But the legislature historically, even though it doesn't have those receipts, can appropriate them in 26?
Chair Josephson, so we have accruals in place for production tax and royalty. So the payments for the June production month, which are due at the end of July, would be accounted for either at the very end of July or the beginning of August. Those are accrued back to fiscal year 2026.
Okay. All right. I have a dozen questions, so I'm going to wait. We have one member and possibly two that have committee hearings. I'm surprised at the lack of hands so far, but I bet we get into this. Rep. Galvin, did you have a question?
Sure. Yes. Thank you, through the chair. And I don't know if I was on your list of those who had a committee meeting, but I'm done. I finished my hearing, just for the record.
Well, you're first in the queue on questions.
Well, thank you so much. So I have a few, and I'm going to just kind of go through them quickly. When we heard slide 16, 10% chance prices are 45 or 130, does that mean 80% chance that it would be somewhere in the middle?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. And
follow up,
if I may, on that same slide, increased revenues are largely a temporary windfall. Are you referring solely to oil and gas, or are you also referring to mining?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, so the increased mining revenue, we are expecting that is has more permanence to it. Market outlook for gold and silver prices in particular is strong into the out years. I was referring to, in terms of the temporary windfall, really looking at something along the lines of slide 13, where the increase to the revenue forecast from high oil prices is most pronounced in fiscal year 26 and 27, with smaller increases in the later years.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may. Slide 15.
Rip Galvin. Mm-hmm.
Slide 15 talks about the, and you mentioned the record gold, silver prices. I just can't tell from looking at this, as I could on the other slides, what your certainty of price is. I assume gold and silver go up and down, and is it just that it goes up and down slower, or what gives you that certainty?
Sure.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin, through the chair. So certainly around gold and silver prices, there's going to be a range of uncertainty similar to oil prices. I haven't looked at exactly what that range of certainty is,
okay.
But that is an astute observation.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may. Thanks. Have you done sensitivity analysis on the revenue resulting from the different oil prices through the rest of the fiscal year? And if not, can you run some? Is that in the back in the index?
Sure. Representative Galvin, through the chair. So I think slide 10 gets at that. And we do have an appendix in the spring revenue forecast that also shows sensitivity tables. That was something that we added to the spring revenue forecast, was sensitivity analysis around the rest of fiscal 26 as well as fiscal years 27 through 29, really acknowledging the uncertainty in the market today. So slide 10, the oil prices on the x-axis represent the average oil price for March through June. So what does prices average for essentially the rest of the fiscal year, and how does that impact unrestricted revenue?
Thank you. A follow-up, if I may?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you.
I
appreciate it. So, and I think what I heard, and I want to make sure I heard it correctly, is that $1 change at this point of the year would mean a $15 million plus or minus. Is that accurate?
Representative Galvin, through the chair, yes. So for March through June, a $1 change in that average oil price over the March through June period is a $15 million change in unrestricted revenue.
But that's at these prices.
Around these prices, correct. And then we do have the detailed sensitivity matrices in the appendix of the forecast.
Right. So if a barrel were $65, the benefit to the Treasury is much larger at that price point.
Chair Josephson, correct. So generally, the revenue sensitivity has a progressive element. So at lower oil prices, the incremental revenue per dollar of price is less than it is at higher prices.
Rep. Galvin for Mr. Stickle.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. So in looking at slide 5, it shows us all of the different types of revenue. It really, the bulk of it is in the investment revenue. And that is projected out to be roughly level. And I know part of that is that we're taking the last 5 years, and then there's kind of a buffer there. But I guess my question is that, is there also some uncertainty around the market? And if you could describe that.
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Representative Galvin, through the chair. So certainly there's uncertainty around the investment returns as well. We've seen there's been volatility in the stock market for sure so far this month, as along with the volatility in the oil revenue. In unrestricted investment revenue is a more stable revenue source, specifically because of the way that we account for that revenue with the trailing market average for the percent of market value. So that filters out a lot of the short-term volatility and uncertainty.
I do have a follow-up, if I may, and this will be my last one
all
for
right,
now.
Rep. Galvin for Mr. Strickland.
Thank you. The last question is related to what you were just describing. And I don't pretend to know what is true here, but have we made investments in oil and gas in ways that would be trailing or mirroring or shadowing what we're seeing in oil prices? In other words, could we potentially see for Alaska, because maybe we've been specific around the price of oil, and I don't know that to be true, but is it possible that maybe our investments have protected us through this time, or another, or could we even be seeing a big plus in the market, or is the market that in our corpus where we have our investments, are they very spread and not really something that we could call fortuitous for this particular time?
Representative Galvin to the chair. So in terms of our investments, you know, there's a very broad, diversified portfolio of investments. Certainly energy is one component of that. Mm-hmm. That's really all I have to share right now.
Okay, thank you.
I know Rep. Stapp is next. I know Rep. Hannon had questions. It looks like Rep. Bynum does. So we'll go to Rep. Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Jefferson, through the chair to Mr. Stickle. Always a pleasure to see you, Mr. Stickle. Just a quick question. So I got a bill downstairs that's being held. It's cost me $370 million for FY26. Based on your projections, should I expect $360 million in FY26 based on your forecast through the chair?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Stapp through the chair. The most likely case is yes, but I would expect that with the knowledge that there's a large amount of uncertainty around that revenue.
Yeah, fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair to Mr. Stickle. Will I be more certain by May 10th or 15th than I am now through the chair?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Stapp through the chair, yes.
My fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up. Rep. Stapp for Mr. Stickle.
Thank you. So based on my available information today, I can reliably decide that I'm going to pass a bill, appropriate money for my contractors and stuff like that. And if things change, I will get to see your wonderful persona appear again, Mr. Stickle, I imagine. And then I can take action on a different bill at the end of May. You think that's fair through the chair?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Stapp through the chair, I think that's a policy call on the timing of those decisions.
Cool. Well, Mr. Chair, it sounds like the meeting's over. Thanks.
You're welcome to go. We'll continue. Rep. Hannon, then Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Stickle, on page 4, when you described additional revenue from non-petroleum corporate tax revenue, and you said some of that was one time, and I'm hoping you could expand on that a little more.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Hannon through the chair. So we had some significant payments that came in the month of December, and we do not expect those. We don't expect that level of payments to continue. That's really the long and short of it without getting into taxpayer-specific information.
Rep. Hannon for Mr. Stickle.
So thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. One follow-up. Are they settlements of can you tell us if they are settlements for previous disputed tax amounts or just anomalies that are one time only?
Mr. Stewart.
Representative Hannon through the chair. No, so these are payments for the tax year 2025 liabilities. Basically, companies get to the end of the year, they realize that their tax year 2025 liability is going to be higher than they had previously thought, and make a large payment in December. And so that's what that one time was. And then in addition to that, we had just general strength in a couple of specific resource-related industries.
Okay, thank you.
Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair, back to slide 7. So when we're looking at this slide, you have the average price of 74 on there. And then when we go skip forward, and you don't need to change the slide yet because I'm going to be coming back to 7.
Sure.
When we skip forward, make sure I'm going forward. Yes, skip forward to slide 11. We have the average that we've had for July through February. That's at 67.34. This obviously is a bigger window of time. Are we only looking at the daily averages to come up with, or the daily numbers to come up with this average? And if so, are those the daily averages that we're coming up with? And the second part of that question is have you considered curating the data in such a way that we would throw out the extremes, like a certain percentage of lows and highs, so we can come up with more of a real average number? And if so, is this about the same as what that would have been?
A couple of questions there, Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Representative Bynum through the chair. And so looking at slide 7 specifically, so these are daily prices. And we put the average in there not to say that $74.13 is any magic number, but just to kind of show roughly a line of central tendency, and that prices have kind of ranged around this $70-ish price range over the last several years, but that there has been a lot of volatility historically up and down below that. The numbers that we showed on slide 11, those are monthly prices as opposed to daily prices. We showed the monthly prices on slide 11 because when companies go to make their production tax and royalty payments, they are paying on a monthly value.
Follow up for a new question?
New question, Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. Representative Stapp had talked a little bit about some uncertainty, or the idea of uncertainty for the spring forecast, specifically related to the remainder of the FY26 that we're currently in. When I'm trying to recall back, and if I remember right, we were sitting here a year ago about this time talking about the spring forecast, and similar questions came up about uncertainty of what the oil prices might be as we look forward. Does our uncertainty change at all from the previous forecast or the current forecast about where we're currently sitting? And the reason why I'm asking the question is because we established and based our whole budget for FY26 based off the spring forecast. And obviously, we know that we have a couple checkpoints, the fall forecast and now where we're at today, and then we make adjustments accordingly. So I was hoping that you might be able to talk a little bit about the uncertainty in 26 a year ago, or I'm sorry, in 25 a year ago compared to where we are today.
Mr. Stickle.
Absolutely. Representative Bynum through the chair. So oil prices are always inherently volatile and uncertain, and there's always a range of values around a forecasted oil price. That's why we do sensitivity analysis and present that on a regular basis. That's also why I presented slide 8 this year, which shows that volatility, which is a measure of oil price uncertainty. And yeah, in early 2025, we were around that average level of uncertainty, but the level of uncertainty in this forecast is historic. Really, the only time we've had more uncertainty in the last two decades was during the peak of the COVID pandemic.
Thank you. Okay. And I have a few more questions, but I wait for any other members that might have other questions.
Okay. let me ask a few. Mr. Stickle, are you on a panel or informal within the department that does the forecast, that publishes the forecast and makes estimates of, for example, oil price over time?
Chair Josephson, so we, for the oil price forecast, we use the futures market exclusively. We used to, historically, prior to about 6 or 7 years ago, we had a forecast process where we brought a panel of internal and external professionals together and went into a room and produced an oil price forecast. We switched to the futures market as the basis for the oil price forecast because it allows for a more timely forecast a more transparent forecast, and based on historical data, a more accurate forecast.
Okay. I have one question that I want to ask. It's sort of a sensitive question, admittedly, but I'm trying to, in social media, there have been a claim that some legislators knew about this forecast before Friday and some didn't. Is your department, does it treat this the way the Division of Elections would treat ballots, which is apropos because we have an elections bill, where even if some early counting has begun, it's just in an absolute lockbox? Is that how your department treats the forecast in the days leading up to its publication?
Sure. Chair Josephson, so I can speak from my perspective as the economic research group within the tax division. So we do provide internal updates within the administration on a monthly basis. So some of the information about revenue outlook and the fact that we were running ahead of forecast as of the end of February, that information was known to some folks. The oil price forecast itself, we finalized that Wednesday night, and we shared forecast numbers within the administration on Thursday, turned around and published it on Friday. Within our group, and to my knowledge, Department of Revenue, we treat that as confidential in the same way that we would taxpayer information. I can't speak for others within the administration.
Okay. My next question is about a document, and I don't question its being a valid original, worthy of a court hearing, but it notes that the general fund sufficiency balance at this moment or a few days ago was $785 million. Is that $785 million multi-purposed? Is it money above all other? Oh, thank you. Is it money above all other budgeted items? That is somehow it. This doesn't reflect monies not yet obviously posted as severance taxes from delivery to the West Coast. I mean, it couldn't be that. You've already described that. So this is some other $785 million. Is that right?
Chair Josephson, I am not prepared to speak to that number. We'd be happy to follow up with our Treasury professionals on that.
Okay, but let me just ask you broadly. If hypothetically, the state had in its Treasury $785 million balance today, that doesn't mean that those are uncommitted dollars. I assume some of that is needed to pay your salary and my salary and the heat and the fans and all the stuff we do in government. Is that right?
Chair Josephson, so that would be roughly correct. I do know that there can be loans taken from the budget reserve for general fund sufficiency. I know that there is timing of the annual permanent fund draw that's not made all at once. So that is timed out to make sure that we have general fund sufficiency. So it's managed by our Treasury professionals to make sure that we have an amount in the general fund needed to meet our obligations, but not more than we necessarily need. For the permanent fund transfer in particular, the longer you leave that money in the permanent fund, the more money it earns in the permanent fund. So that's kind of phased throughout the year. And again, happy to have the Treasury folks provide more detail on that.
Okay, and you're reminding me that the government can borrow from the CBR, and so even if these dollars haven't arrived because they haven't actually been delivered to the Port of Valdez, for example, in the form of oil to be then turned into severance tax or unrestricted royalty, for example, the bills, that is the costs associated with HB 289, you would submit could be handled in that manner. That, in other words, even if the revenue is short for some reason, that the CBR could be borrowed from to pay for, quote, meet the match, close quote, or to pay for the disaster relief fund. Is that your understanding?
Chair Josephson, Yes, that's my understanding. And then again, you know, happy to have the experts that deal with this as their day job provide more information on that.
All right. Somewhat unrelated to this, I do have a question about an increase identified in petroleum property tax. Your forecast shows from FY16 to last year, FY25, property taxes ranging from $111 million to $134 million. And then starting this year in this document, it jumps to $174 million spending the next decade. And I understand that these projections become necessarily weaker as the years go on. Can you explain the growth in petroleum property tax?
Sure. Chair Josephson, so generally the historical growth in property tax has to do with increased assessed values of property. So the millage rate has remained constant. The assessed value of property for oil and gas in the state has increased over time. Looking at the significant increase in the forecast for this year, we incorporated the preliminary tax roll for calendar year 2026. Those are based on the assessments that were issued quite recently and will be due in payments come June from the oil and gas property taxpayers. That preliminary assessed roll reflected a pretty substantial increase in assessed value for oil and gas property in the state, again, with the largest component of that being for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, where we did a complete reassessment and reevaluation of the value of TAPS for the first time in several years.
All right. Somewhat esoteric, if I'm capable of esoteric. But if I'm looking at a page from House Bill 247, this is circa 2016, a bill from then, and it notes that folks think there's never been changes to SB 21. There really have been. This is one of them. That the gross value reduction at these sorts of prices would be shorter lived, if that's a term. Am I right about that?
Chair Josephson, so the gross value reduction provision of the oil and gas production tax provides a temporary reduction to the value of oil for 7 years, but it expires early if there are 3 years of oil prices over $70 per barrel. And so if the higher oil prices are sustained over $70 per barrel, then there would be an earlier graduation from gross value reduction for eligible fields, which is a really interesting point to our revenue forecast. Once you get out to fiscal year 28 and beyond, we are forecasting $70 exactly for fiscal year 28, 29, and 30, and then $69 per barrel for the 3 years after that. So we are forecasting that we will be just below that point at which company or fields would graduate early.
I could see that folks might want to litigate that if it's that close. Back to the futures and this forecast. Of course, the previous question was sort of part and parcel of that, but you noted a change in policy 6 or 7 years ago. Is the way this was forecasted, did you use the typical previous 5-day futures?
Chair Josephson, yes. So the methodology that we implemented when we went to using the futures market is we used the median futures price from the last 5 trading days. We implemented that, the 5 trading day look back to, we didn't want to have such a long look back that we weren't incorporating the recent information, but we didn't want to use just 1 day of prices given the opportunity for price volatility. I think, you know, soon after we went to the futures market, there was an event where there was an attack in Saudi Arabia and there was a double-digit increase in price 1 day. And then the next day, oh, everything's fine, and prices went back down. And so the median, the 5-day median allows us to filter out any 1 day's volatility. For this forecast, yes, we used the 5-day look back. Our intent was originally to use the first 5 trading days in March. When we got to that Friday, what, March 6th, given what was going on in the market, we said, there's just too much uncertainty. How far out can we push this out? And so we decided to push the 5-day look back to close on Wednesday, March 11th. And so that allowed us to get the most timely forecast we possibly could when, given the March 13th release date.
Okay. I'm pretty well there. I think I'll pivot to Representative Jimmy with my apologies. Representative Jimmy, do you have a question for Mr. Sticker?
Yes, thank you, Court Chair Josephson. Thank you for being here, first of all, Mr. Stickle. So when the SNAP crisis hit during the government shutdown, OMB borrowed $10 million from the Safe Water Village. And people are still waiting for their SNAP benefits. Why hasn't this been paid back yet? Could you help me understand that more?
Yeah,
Mr. Stickle, for yes.
Yeah, Representative Jimmy through the chair, that's not my expertise. I would defer that to OMB.
Thanks.
Okay, Rep. Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair, Mr. Stickle. I'm following up on the questioning from Chair Josephson, getting into accounting weeds a bit, which I know is always dangerous, but here it goes. As I understand it, the state's cash management flexibility, such as the ability to borrow from the CBR as mentioned, is completely separate from the appropriation process where we are authorizing expenditures to be accrued during a particular fiscal year. So essentially cash accounting is different from accrual accounting. And you can get yourself tied up in knots if you confuse the two. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin through the chair, yes, I would agree with that. And we do, for cash management purposes, we have a group within the Treasury Division, Department of Revenue, that specifically evaluates that. We provide them with monthly projections on state revenue to help them make those cash management decisions. But, you know, the point is well taken that the revenue forecast, the accrual-based accounting forecast and the cash management forecast are really three different things that are related.
Thank you. And follow up, if I may.
Yes.
This is just a comment, Representative Josephson. It may behoove us as we're thinking through policy to see if we can hear from more folks around the cash management or rather the cash accounting system. Because I think that some of our questions are related to that, and I don't want us to be making decisions or assumptions because we think we're so smart that we can outthink you. And I don't want to go there. I know that many on this within this committee have a lot of different experience levels, and I appreciate that. At the same time, these are pretty big decisions. So if you would be so kind as to consider that, I'd be grateful.
On that topic, we asked, albeit this morning, we asked for someone from the Treasury to testify on this cash management question. Mm-hmm. You're correct that Ms. Treasurer Leary, for example, deals with this, as does her deputy constantly. But we were referred to Dan Stickle. So here we are.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Appreciate the questions that you'd had. A lot of those were very similar to the things I was thinking about. Through the chair, I just had a few quick questions, just kind of some observation and clarification. So the revenue draws and current balance, that obviously sounds like something else that we can be asking from OMB specifically about that, so I won't ask that now. But if you did know, in general, when we talk about our bank account balance, as you would say, or the unrestricted general fund itself, do you have an idea about what our general policy is for the amount of money necessary to maintain that, or is that something I need to ask OMB?
Mr. Stickle for Rep. Bynum.
Representative Bynum, I don't have that information off the top of my head.
Sure.
And we'd be happy to consult with our Treasury folks and get back to you.
Through the chair. Thank you. I can, I'll just follow up with them on that to get a specific number. The,
Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Through the chair. So there's some questions about this 6734 number and confidentiality about the actual forecast. Would it be fair for me to say that if I had a question about kind of where we had been and what current prices were, that if I were to pick my phone up and call your department or call legislative finance, that they would likely be able to give me that number?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Bynum, through the chair, I would be happy to assist with that.
For clarity, I mean, like last week, if I'd have picked my phone up and I would have called and I said, hey, can you guys tell me what kind of the prices have been since July? Would you be able to share that number with me?
Yes, absolutely. Representative Bynum through the chair. So that's not a confidential number. We publish oil prices on a daily basis on our website at tax.alaska.gov. And we have a history of monthly average prices or prevailing value going back many, many years. And that's all publicly available information.
Okay. Is there a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. Rep. Bynum for Mr. Stickle.
Thank you, sir. So also with that, if I were to pick up my phone and call Ledge Finance and I were to give them this number or call your department and say, how much revenue would this reflect? Would you be able to give me just a good estimate on what that would be worth to us as we currently sit?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Bynum through the chair, absolutely. And we did, you know, one of the things that we published in this spring revenue forecast was detailed sensitivity matrices to make that plainly clear and available to the public.
And then one final, and then I'll be done.
Yep. Rep. Bynum, follow up.
So thank you. Through the chair, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the EIA.gov, they post future numbers for where oil prices currently are and where they are likely to go. Would it be out of bounds for me to say that if I were to go last week and look at what oil futures are through EIA, that they would probably give me a good reflection about where oil prices are likely going to end up? And then from that, I could deduce that oil prices are going to be higher than where we currently sit.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Bynum through the chair. So we would need to look at the exact day of futures prices that the Energy Information Agency was pulling. The futures market, especially for the next several months, the remainder of fiscal year 26, has been extremely volatile. And so we had, you know, if you look at the futures market at the end of last week when the Alaska price was over $110 per barrel, or pushing $110 per barrel, you would end up with a higher price expectation for the rest of this year and early next year than if you pulled it on a different day.
Perfect. And so just to follow up or follow just up? A clarification. So, but in there that organization does provide general overall outlooks and summaries about how they collect that data and what they would expect to see going into the future about whether or not markets are going to be average on higher or lower. Isn't that correct?
Sure. Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Representative Bynum through the chair. So I'm somewhat familiar with the Energy Information Agency. So they produce an annual energy outlook that provides long-term expectations and then a short-term energy outlook that provides more near-term expectations. They publish both a forecast that they produce themselves as well as they'll publish a futures market outlook similar to the way that we do. Their internal forecast is based on a supply-demand driven model, and so they make assumptions around supply-demand and derive what a price outlook would be based on that.
Okay. Thank you. Co-Chair Shruggy.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Dan, for being here today, Mr. Stickle. And presenting what is your likely forecast, what you believe is the most likely scenario looking forward. We've talked a lot about volatility. Can you just, at a high level, does volatility, high volatility, extreme volatility mean that we're less likely to be right or that we are going to see wilder swings or both? Can you just put a little bit of punctuation behind volatility and what that means for us?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Shragi, or Co-Chair Shragi, yes, both. So volatility basically means that the range of expected potential future prices is wider. And so we are more likely to be wrong and more likely to be wrong to a larger extent. So the level of certainty that we have, so when you have a low volatility and you say oil prices are expected to be $75 per barrel, maybe that's plus or minus $5 per barrel. Now when we say oil prices are going to be $70 per barrel, that could be, you know, plus or minus $30 per barrel or more.
Follow up. Thank you. appreciate that. You know, I'm just thinking about some of the debate that occurred today and the options that are before us. We outlined, or we heard on the floor, and I think would be, it was backed up in my conversations with Legislative Finance Division, that when you look at the supplementals we've received so far, and there could be some additional ones that we receive, if we rely on your forecast and you're exactly right, and how many times have we been exactly right on the forecast?
Mr. Strickland.
Co-Chair Shragi, I think it happened once.
Once. Okay, good. A lot of years. Very good. If you guys are exactly right and there's no additional supplementals for fiscal year 26, we will end the year with $32 million in our savings account. You outlined in your presentation a number of scenarios, including, you know, the 10% lowest chance and the 10% highest chance. What would you say is the chance that we're off by more than $2? And the reason I'm asking about $2 mm-hmm. is because we heard the price sensitivity is that about every dollar equals $15 million. And so if we have $30 million left over in the tank at the end of the year, what are the chances that we see our forecast shift by more than $2 and we no longer have sufficient funds to pay all of our bills as outlined in the appropriation we had in front of us today?
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Co-Chair Shragi, so yes, lots of uncertainty around the revenue forecast. I would point to slide 9, where we put some probabilities around different price forecasts. Roughly a slightly less than 50% chance that we come in, you know, more than $2 below the forecast, but the level of certainty that we will hit our exact forecast is low in either direction.
Okay. So seems to me, and not necessarily a question for you, but seems to me the chance that we come up short this year is a pretty high certainty, basically a coin flip in an extremely volatile environment. I don't know about either of you or any of the committee members, but I don't generally like making major financial decisions as my household or in businesses that I've helped to operate in the past on a 50% chance of being able to pay my bills. So I'm glad we didn't adjourn the meeting earlier. I think there's still some further conversation to have. Thank you, Mr. Stickle.
Rip Galvin.
Thank you, Coach Justison. I'd like to switch to slide 13 and talk about something a little more positive, I hope. So this slide is a little longer forecast out, and I just want to be clear on this piece because I think the public might not appreciate that what we're looking at is overall revenue, which would be price combined with production. Is that right?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin through the chair, correct. So slide 13 is all unrestricted revenue. So this incorporates the percent of market value transfer. It incorporates total oil revenue, which is a function of price, production, lease expenditures. It also incorporates non-petroleum revenue, where we highlighted, you know, one industry in particular that we're expecting to be a more significant contributor to the long-term forecast.
So
if I may follow up,
thank you. So thinking it through, especially along the lines of oil and gas, but certainly mining and the other pieces are investments and such. But especially I'm thinking about oil and gas because I know for the short term, this volatility is very a concern. But when Willow and Pikka and other big projects come into play, and certainly when we see that we're shifting the percentage of royalties that we're getting from the federal government down the line, we're going to see a much rosier picture. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin through the chair. by a definition of rosy, yes.
Okay.
So we are, you know, you mentioned we do have some major new developments that are coming online, expected to contribute to increased revenue in later years, aside from the oil price forecast issue.
What I can't see, thank you, follow up. What I can't see here is, did you have an estimated year after year increase, a percentage? In other words, I don't know if this line tracks with what could be CPI. If you could help me with that.
Mr. Stickle.
Yeah. Representative Galvin through the chair. So from fiscal year 26 through the end of the time horizon, the revenue forecast roughly aligns with inflation. Okay. So if we were to put this in real terms, it would be a roughly a flat revenue forecast in real terms from the adjusted fiscal year 26 forecast, which is about $500 million higher than it was in the fall.
Thank you.
You bet. Rep Stapp for Mr. Stickle.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot of excuses for the unwillingness to take action on a bill that I have before me in the Rules Committee. So I'm going to reiterate my previous question to Mr. Stickle through the chair. In the event that the volatility in your forecast bears a different result, Mr. Stickle, will you be coming back to this committee, letting us know, and recommending a different course of action through the chair?
Mr. Stickle, in court, we'd say objection asked and answered, but go ahead, Mr. Stickle.
Representative Stapp through the chair, I would be delighted to come back to the committee if invited.
We'd always love to have you. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Mr. Stickle, when the revenue comes in from industry, typically a month after delivery on the West Coast, as I understand it, would the administration... Because it would not be enough to pay all four items we have in our bill at one sitting. Would the administration have the discretion to say, all right, we're going to put a little in the higher education investment fund. We're going to pay meet the match next. I mean, is that up to the administration, as you understand it?
Chair Josephson, so if I understand the question you're asking about the uses of the general fund revenue as it comes in?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That would be a question I defer to Office of Management and Budget.
I think that's a fair answer. Rep. Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And in years past, I imagine that we've experienced a late, unexpected drop in oil prices. And what has been the outcome of that unexpected drop in revenue when the budget has already been approved and the revenue doesn't show up? Does the state shut down? Or does it declare bankruptcy, or does it just have to get fixed and in the next year's budget, if that's approved, if it's approved, what does that look like?
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Representative Galvin through the chair. And again, my role is on the revenue side of things and the revenue outlook. I would defer those questions.
Thanks.
Mr. Stickle, were there any change in how the department looked at ANS Brent differentials when it looked at the forecast?
Chair Josephson, no. So we have a convention that we assume that the ANS Brent differential from whatever the recent value is through the end of the fiscal year will revert to zero, which is kind of theoretically where you'd expect that ANS would trade at a roughly parity to Brent. We maintained that convention for this forecast.
And I'll go to my co-chair here in a second. Just since the legislature can peg its balanced budget on the most recent forecast, and that's this, as I understand it, for FY27, it would be logical for us to assume, given the volatility, $510 million more than we had a week ago.
Chair Josephson, that is the information in the spring revenue forecast. Yes.
Okay. Co-Chair Shruggy.
Mr. Tickle, are you familiar with the CBR language that's in both versions of the supplemental we've seen most recently, the version that was just on the House floor here this last week and then the version that was sent over to the Senate. Are you familiar with the two different structures of CBR language?
Co-Chair Shragi, I'm really not. To be honest, our revenue forecast, we've been so busy crunching the numbers on that, and that was done completely independently of any of this supplemental CBR discussion.
Fair enough. Co-Chair Josephson, did I hear you earlier that you had requested OMB to be here today and they denied and pointed to Department of Revenue? Who did you request to be here today?
I asked, well, this is so, it's important to get this right. I asked my staffer, Alexander Schroeder, to ask someone from the Treasury Division or section to join these fine people.
I see.
And they directed us to Mr. Stickle, as I understand it.
Thank you. Yeah, part of my concern is that we ultimately – look, the revenues may very well come in as forecasted or even higher than forecasted. I think the concern that I and others have is what happens in the nearly 50% likelihood scenario that prices come in below what is forecasted and what that means for our ability to meet our obligations. I've heard that we can just come back and pass another appropriation. I don't know that the governor has really requested that we even pay this appropriation. So you know, I have some concern in that regard, and I think, frankly, we need to have OMB before us at some point, because in the event that we just, say, send the appropriation without a reasonable level of certainty that the funds are available for – that they will come in and be available for appropriation to meet our obligations, my understanding is that the department is able to pick and choose what they fund. And that gives me a lot of concern as we look forward. I don't know how – those appropriations will be prioritized. I also just have concern that I've only been doing this. This is now my sixth year. Things only get more challenging as you get closer to the end of the second session. And so I have some concern over our ability to – this isn't a question for you, Mr. Stickle, but I appreciate the attention. I have some concern that we're going to be able to meet our obligations and have certainty around all of these appropriations. So just voicing some concern as we wrestle with this issue. I agree we need to make sure that these appropriations ultimately end up getting passed, but I do want to make sure that we're able to meet our obligations. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson.
Before I go to Rep. Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi's questions raise an important point. So in a fiscal year where, well, until 3 weeks ago, there was virtually none to little volatility. Not really. I mean, we're sort of in that $62 to $67 range. We still had $500 million in supplementals due to Halong, due to controversy that I won't get into over vetoes, all of those elements. And so the newly electeds that come in 2027, given this range that you've described, the supplemental situation could be worse.
Co-Chair Josephson, it could be. And, you know, I think you're asking the right questions around the certainty of revenue. It is a very uncertain forecast and uncertain time in the world with what's going on right now.
Rep. Bynum, sorry.
If I may also just briefly respond to the question about inviting our folks from Treasury. So there may have been a misunderstanding of exactly what information was requested. I think the thought was that the question was around what the monthly revenue forecast is on a monthly basis, and I'm fully prepared to provide monthly detail as opposed to exactly the mechanisms of how that money is allocated to different funds over time.
Well, since I'm feeling extra honest, I typically am honest, in my mind's eye, I had it about – my question was about cash flow and when receipts from severance taxes arrived, and you've answered that more than adequately.
Sure. Yeah, and Chair Josephson, we do have a monthly analysis of cash flow that I'm happy to provide details on.
Okay. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Since there's been a lot of questions and comments brought up about appropriated dollars, and you're the revenue guy, tells us how much cash is actually going to be coming in or projected to be coming in. Right now, the FY26 management plan says that we have about $6.034 billion in that plan. We have another $461 million in supplemental. Assuming that that actually gets appropriated through a bill, that gives us a full plan, including supplementals, of $6.495 billion. That's what's appropriated. Now, obviously, that's not what's actually being obligated and or expended. Can you give me an idea of how much cash you need on hand when these appropriations are made at the beginning of the year, when a supplemental is made? Do we need $6.495 billion available on day one? Or do we need to make sure that those revenues are available in the general fund when we actually go to obligate them and go to pay the bills?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Bynum, through the chair, again, I would defer those technical questions on the appropriations and expenditures to OMB.
Rep.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
So you said, thank you, through the chair, Mr. Stipple, you had indicated that you could talk about revenues in general that were on a monthly basis. From your experience, do you see that the equal of revenue is available on day one of the appropriation?
Mr. Stickle.
Represented by him through the chair, no. Obviously, revenues come in throughout the year, including when you adjust for accruals at the end of the year. Some of those revenues actually, some of the revenues for fiscal year 26 will come in August of fiscal year 26, for instance.
Thank you.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Stickle, on slide 24, which is part of your appendix, non-petroleum revenue, non-petroleum corporate income tax, we see a substantial drop in FY27 compared to FY26. Can you talk to me a little bit about that drop that we are anticipating?
Sure.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Hannon through the chair. So for the non-petroleum corporate income tax, the fiscal year 2026 numbers, as I spoke to earlier, includes some one-time payments that we really don't expect to be part of the forecast going forward. I think the more appropriate comparison would be fiscal year 2027 to fiscal year 2025, where we are seeing a significant increase of almost $50 million. Okay. And that has to do the mining industry is a big portion of that, where we're forecasting now, I think, $80 million from mining corporate in fiscal year 2027.
Yeah, up from 49.
Up from 49 in fiscal 26 and 29.5 in fiscal 25. So that really is the story of the increase in corporate income tax, aside from those one-time payments.
Okay.
Follow up,
because I guess when I asked you earlier and you explained that one time, in my mind it was that corporation's done really good, and so their quarterly prediction of where they were going to be was off. So in December they had a much bigger last quarter payment to you, but the following year they'd be paying them on a regular basis, anticipating their level. But you're saying, and you said it before, I just wasn't understanding that way, it was truly one-time corporate profits that they're not going to repeat on an ongoing basis.
Mr. Stern.
Correct. Representative Hannon through the chair. So there were some one-time receipts that we are expecting truly were one-time, and that's really all I can say on that matter.
Okay.
Could I ask one other?
You may.
And it's not called out here, but in other hearings, we've talked about the marijuana industry taxes having shown a fairly substantial decline over the last four, maybe five fiscal years. In your forecasting, are you continue with that decline over the next two fiscal years?
Mr. Stickler.
Sure. Representative Hand through the chair. So we are forecasting declines in the marijuana tax overall. Marijuana consumption has actually come in a little bit stronger than we were expecting. But we are forecasting the reason for the decline in marijuana tax specifically does not have to do with consumption overall. It has to do with the share of consumption to different product types. So we're seeing a shift in consumption from the higher tax bud and flower to a lower tax trim and immature. And we are expecting that trend to continue.
Thank you.
Okay. That was, in my mind, pretty thorough. Would our presenters like to add anything else?
Co-Chair Josephson, thank you for the opportunity to present. I think a lot of the questions have kind of reiterated what is really the theme for us in producing this forecast, which is it's a time of uncertainty. We're anticipating additional revenue, but with everything going on in the world, just a very challenging time to be predicting state revenue and a challenging time to be a policymaker. So good luck.
Okay. I want to thank the...
Thanks.
It was all fine until that moment. I want to thank Mr. Stickle and Acting Commissioner Earls for their presentation. We're going to take a brief at ease and move on to the next item in the calendar. We're at ease at 2:59.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle.
Okay, House Finance back on record at 3 p.m. we have two bills before us, but unless we get through the first one very quickly, I don't think we're going to get to the second one. The first one being Senate Bill 64, the elections bill, and then we also have committee substitute for House Bill 280. That's the highly digitized tax bill. But as I mentioned, I get the feeling we probably won't get to House Bill 280, so just so folks have a heads up. so I'd like to invite Senator Wilikowski, Wilikowski's staff, Mr. David Dunsmore, and Director Carol Beecher with the Division of Elections to the table. If you could please come up to ask questions. And Mr. Dunsmore, before we start, let's see here. I think you're going to walk us through an updated sectional. And we'll take questions, and let's see, I think, what else do we have here? And then we'll wrap it up. So with that, Mr. Dunsmore.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilikowski. I can briefly walk through the sectional. Most of the section... the general description remains unchanged. So do you want me to go through section by section or only jump to the end where they change?
What was the second part?
You want me to go through each individual section or just because all of the change descriptions are at the end? Do you want me to go through all 35 sections or just at the end?
Maybe just hit the high points, and then if folks have questions, we can go to those.
The substantial changes happen at Section 30. So I'll just start there. Section 30 from the previous version was removed from this bill. So Section 30 in this bill is the requirement for a report to the legislature by the first day of the 35th legislature with recommendations for expanding early and absentee voting in rural communities and low-income neighborhoods. Section 31 is the section that states that the crimes referenced in sections 25 through 27 only apply to offenses committed after the effective date of this act. Section 32 is a new transitional section allowing the division to adopt regulations to implement provisions of this bill before the effective date of these provisions. Section 33 is another new transitional section similarly allows the division to begin the procurement process to implement this bill before the effective dates of those provisions. Section 34 is the provision making the ballot tracking and ballot curing provisions conditional on both becoming law. Section 35 is the January 1st, 2027 effective date for the clarification for true source definition for ballot measure and question campaigns. Section 36 is an immediate effective date for those two new transitional sections. And Section 37 is an August 31st, 2026 effective date for the remainder of the bill.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to maybe check in with Ms. Carol Beecher to see if I know there's some discussion about what could and if there's a list maybe of things that you thought could and could not be done. I don't know if there's – I don't see a handout or anything, but I just wanted to check in before we go to questions on the sectional. If you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Carol Beecher, Director of the Division of Elections. We haven't had a chance to – thoroughly analyzed, but from our look at it at this point, it looks like the only sections that we would struggle to implement would be the ones that we've noted previously, which are the cure and the ballot tracking. The rest of it, we believe we could implement prior.
Okay. Any questions from the committee on anything? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Ms. Beecher. Thank you for coming back, and it's good to see you again in person. I was hoping that there, you know, there's a few items in the bill that I've heard from members of the public and also some other legislators that they have some questions about, like, kind of the functional mechanism. And so Section 10, I believe it's still Section 10, is the rural community liaison. I was hoping that maybe you could talk a little bit about this bill passes, it goes into law. Functionally, what is your department doing with regard to this position, and how is it functionally work?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, functionally, it would require, once this bill was implemented, it would require us to then have the position created, go out for recruitment for the position, and then make a determination on which communities had the most need. We imagine that it would likely be a position based in Anchorage and would work with the various entities in Anchorage that are also working toward making sure that the different small communities have the polling staff necessary, as well as in Southeast. We haven't really fleshed out exactly the position description at this point.
Okay. Follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair, I'm really wondering, because I know that we have challenges at times for recruitment, and the functional gap that might be left in place if you're not able to actually recruit and hire somebody for this position. What does the division do in the event that we get coming up to the election and you don't have this particular position filled? And or temporaries that are assisting that position, what is it that the department actually does to comply with the law?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. The division has five regional offices. Within that, we have the three for most of the regions, full-time staff. And then we pull in multiple temporary workers. And some of those positions include recruiters, whose sole responsibility is to find the poll workers, keep in contact with them. They're essentially their point of contact during the election for poll workers and for staffing. So it would be something of that nature.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. I have another question.
Sure, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Section 27 of the bill specifically talks about crimes, and we're including crimes in here. Again, I've had fellow representatives and members of the public reach out to me and specifically ask about this section. It's talking about a person commits the crime of election official misconduct in the first degree if. And then we're listing some of the items in here. The question that had come up was specifically, how do we deal with a scenario where the division itself doesn't necessarily implement and or carry out what's currently in law? Could they fall under this new definition that's being added as far as knowingly, there's a section that's being added that says knowingly disclose shares or reports a person who's not an elected official. So that's the new part about adding into this. But there's also the existing section where we talk about basically a misconduct. Does a current employee of the Division of Elections outside of the field, out in the field, like working polls, do they fall under any kind of legal obligation to actually carry out the statutes we put in place?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, they would fall under that they would be required to follow the law. They are not allowed to disclose information outside of the division. So, yes, they would fall under this.
Follow up. So all the provisions of this bill, for example, the requirement for our voter roll cleanup, our requirement for sending out notices, if the division employees were to not carry out those, is there any kind of legal action from a criminal perspective that's looked at, or is this purely civil matter?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't know the answer for that, but that would be something we can discuss with law.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Next question, Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Thank you all for being here for the second time around today. It's good to see everybody. So this bill, a rural community liaison at Division of Elections, someone whose job is to work with tribes and in communities on absentee voting access, nothing like this exists in law right now. What does this position mean for villages in rural areas?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, we would flesh out what all of the different responsibilities were for this position. And we have not done that to date. So that is something we would be working on to see exactly what was needed and required for this position.
Maybe if I could ask Senator Wilikowski, I'm sure that you've had some organizations reach out to you and talk a little bit about the challenges that rural communities have had and the need for this position. Maybe if you could add a little to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Jimmy. This provision comes from the concern that we've had in many, many rural communities, many in your district, in fact, that can't find poll workers, have huge percentages of their voters who are disenfranchised because they have problems with absentee ballots. There are mailing issues. And so this is written in a fairly broad manner. And the idea is to, as it says, collaborate with tribes and municipalities to facilitate access in rural areas to absentee voting and where it is available early voting, and ensure that the precincts in the rural areas of the state are adequately staffed. We know that there were numerous precincts where they couldn't find any staff at all. And so certainly in this upcoming election, the idea, at least from my perspective, would be that the rural liaison would work to ensure that there are poll workers, ensure that you have polls that can actually open in every single precinct in Alaska, and to ensure that those who are casting votes in Alaska, in rural Alaska, are not disenfranchised. That's what the intent is.
Representative Jimmy?
Thank you for your understanding on that issue. I see too many times in my district, and you hear of other rural areas that are not given the right to vote because they cannot find poll worker. But my follow-up question is that the liaison is also required to make sure rural precincts are adequately staffed. What has it meant in the past when rural precincts didn't have enough poll workers on election day?
That'd be for a question, Mr. Dunsmore.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, for the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilikowski. There have been numerous instances where polls have either not opened at all on election day or have opened later in the afternoon with the division having to scramble to find someone willing to step into the position at the last minute. Where we've seen that happen in villages where, you know, say a poll opens at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon or later, you've noticed significantly less voter turnout than in elections in which the polls in that same village had been open the same day. There's also, issues with some of the smaller remote communities that are in that there have been some precinct consolidation. For example, I believe Nanwalek in the Kenai Peninsula is in the same precinct as Tyonek, which is on the other side of Cook Inlet, meaning that they're short of a boat or a chartered plane. There's not really a way for people to vote in person. So facilitating the ability for people in communities like that to have an in-person opportunity for absentee voting is critical and would be something we would expect that position would work on.
Follow up. So they don't open later, right? So if they open later, they might not get to vote at all. Is that correct?
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, I mean, there have been instances where polls have in certain precincts have not opened at all. Obviously, there's a reason why the polls are open throughout the day, and the data bears out that where polls have opened later, there have been significantly less voter turnout, indicating that there are voters who were not able to vote, who had they been afforded the same opportunity as urban residents whose polls were open all day, probably would have had the opportunity, they would have voted.
Although consolidation sounds really like a good idea, especially in rural areas, it wouldn't be good because being out in rural is unique. And I've had a constituent who said he was going to go vote for me. And then, of course, I haven't seen him till after elections. And he asked, hey, did you win? And I said, yeah. I was like, didn't you go vote? His response was, I didn't go vote, not because I didn't want to go vote for you. I didn't go vote for you because the river had broken up and where the election was on the other side of the river. And I don't feel, he said, I didn't want to put my life at risk to go vote, even though he wanted to go. So even though consolidation does sound, it's not good. I don't agree with consolidations.
Mr. Densmore.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, to clarify, this bill does not consolidate any precincts. I was just using as an example that there are some precincts that have been consolidated with smaller communities, likely as a result of the division not feeling they're able to adequately staff. I believe another example of where you would have to go across the water, I believe in Southeast, there's Pelican and Elfin Cove are communities that are separated by water but are in the same precinct. So there's numerous examples across the state where voters have to travel a significant distance to get to their in-person polling place.
I'm just glad to hear there's nothing in there for consolidation. Thanks, you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. I just had two more, well, I probably have more than two, but for right now, I only have two more questions, and they're really functional, like how do we do that or what does it mean type of questions. The first one is specifically around Section 1 and 2. It's dealing with federally recognized tribes and ID. Now, I appreciate the sponsor for putting this in the bill. I think that this is actually a good change in how we're changing the ID requirements in the bill. But I've had some folks ask me questions about what does that mean when we say a tribal ID. I know from my experience with tribal IDs, and I have quite a few tribes in my district, and I work with them, and they travel, and they have TSA and things like that. So I have a better idea about what's happening in my district when it comes to tribal ID. But I was hoping that you might be able to, Ms. Beecher, explain just a little bit when we add this section into law, what does it specifically mean? And when we talk about the tribal ID, what type of ID are we actually talking about?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I would defer on that to the sponsors of the bill. I actually haven't seen the ID like that, the tribal ID. Okay. But it would mean if this bill passes that the hunting and fishing license, which are currently able to be used for ID at the polls, would no longer be available.
Okay.
Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Bynum. My understanding is the division actually already does accept tribal IDs at polling places, but the tribal IDs are federally recognized IDs. I think this is important to understand already. They're accepted by the TSA. In place of real IDs, they're accepted. They can be used as an ID to get a passport. They're valid at banks. They're valid at federal buildings. They're valid at airports. So these are – and they're – challenging to get. The different tribes have somewhat different requirements, but they generally require a birth certificate. They generally require proof of tribal citizenship. And as mentioned, they are very, very broadly federally recognized IDs in place of real ID.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fossey. I really appreciate you really talking about it. I don't think we had talked about it on record yet. And that it can be challenging the qualifications to make sure that you're getting these tribal IDs can be very – the requirement can be very steep to demonstrate that. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, and I'm really glad that we've included it in the bill. My second question is for Ms. Beecher. It's Section 23, the ballot tracking system and multi-factor authentication. From a practicality perspective, how does the division see that this – element will be implemented, and what the value does this element in the bill bring to either ballot security and or communication to the voter?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So the ballot tracking system, the division currently has a My Voter portal where individuals can confirm some of these things already. For example, we can confirm that the voter's ballot was sent. People can log in and see the date it was sent. They can also see the receipt of the ballot by the division. And the new component, of course, is the providing the information necessary to cure the ballot. We have a form of the multi-factor, but it's not the kind where you can have a number that is sent to your mobile device. It's you have to contact us, and we give you a number to log in there for your personal login. So functionally, most of these things are already in place. The component that of allowing the voter to confirm that the division that they received their ballot, that would be up to the voter for the most part to use the United States Postal Service, notifying them what mail they're getting. They could contact us and say, I got my ballot, if they wanted to. But as far as a practical matter, there's not a lot of value in that for the division to know that you received it, because we would look to when we get it back.
Okay. Is that a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. When we look at this, would this be something, would you imagine this would be something very similar to like My PFD or My Alaska or My Alaska Fishing Game, like where you can actually just log in and just check status? Has it been received yet? Has it been mailed? And that kind of thing. If that's, I know that requires usually some kind of multi-level authentication to get into My PFD, for example. Is that what we envision that this will actually functionally do?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes. Yes, with the addition of the cure components, so that the voters can are notified on what they can do to cure their ballot.
Okay. And I had a question, Co-Chair Foster, with regard to Section 9, and it's dealing with the breaches.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you. So in Section 9, we have this new language where we talk about breaches, and I believe that there was an addition to this section in the bill that talks about information potentially being held. Make sure I'm in the right section, because it was the maybe it was when I wrote down the notes, it might have been from the old section. So Section notifying of breaches of confidential information, Section 9. there was a section that was in section 9, there was a portion put into this bill, and it talked about may delay the publishing of the notice of the data breach if law enforcement agencies are investigating. Is this just for public notice as a broad general notice, or will the voter be directly still, will they be given this information that if my information as a voter has been breached, am I going to have to wait for law enforcement to give the thumbs up because of an ongoing investigation, or will I be notified that something is afoot or that there's been an issue and that law enforcement is engaged in the activity?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I can speak to previous breaches where I was in a division where another department had a data breach that impacted the division I was working in, and we were not told anything about the data breach or any details about it for quite some time because it involved levels of federal government looking into the breach. So it kind of depends on the level of the breach and the bad actors involved.
Okay. Thank you. And then my final question is,
sure. Representative Bynum,
page 16, lines 8 and 9, speaking to one of the members, one of my colleagues that's been working closely with this bill, page 16, lines 8 and 9. Let's see what section that is. I don't have it in front of me here. So that's in section 28, I believe. And that portion was stricken out as removed, and it has to do with is a citizen of the United States and is at least 18 years of age or will be within 90 days of the date of the application. And that's been removed from here. The member I was speaking with said that potentially that was being removed unintentionally, but I'm not exactly sure what the thought of the sponsor of the bill and or what the impact to this would be from Ms. Beecher. So either one would be fine.
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I believe the original intent of repealing that language was that providing that data would potentially be used by the division to cross-reference to see whether the people who had indicated to the PFD that they weren't citizens or that they were under the age of 18 to cross-reference the database. Having further discussions with the Division of Elections and then talks with other legislators who we've been working on the bill with, we would support. In fact, we've already ordered an amendment to undo that repeal that we could provide to your office if you would like that.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative Jimmy?
Liana Co-Chair Foster. So the bill requires a bill tracking system. What does it mean for a village voter to be able to track their ballot on their phone and to make sure that their ballot arrives safely?
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, the purpose of the ballot tracking system is really twofold. The idea is to allow voters to have the security and the knowledge of whether their ballot has in fact been received. Since we're aware, you know, there's a deadline for ballots have to be received within 10 days of the election if they're coming from within the United States. Voters, of course, want to know whether the ballot's been received and what step it is in the process. This is probably going to be more of a concern for voters in rural Alaska, where they experience more regular delays in the post office than urban voters. I know the other concern that from some legislators who had brought the tracking provision forward is the idea that voters would also be able to, if they haven't requested an absentee ballot, give themselves some peace of mind that they can go in and see that, in fact, there has been no ballot requested in their name, and so that that would help deal with some perception concerns that if voters were worried about that, they would be able to see that their identity is not being used for that purpose.
Question?
Representative Jimmy?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. This bill also says that if a ballot is rejected, the Division of Election, the division must call, text, and email the voter within 24 hours. Why does this matter most for rural voters who vote by mail more than anyone else in Alaska?
Mr. Densmore.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, we know that's been spoken about by you and by Representative Bynum and Director Beecher of many of the challenges facing holding elections and anything by mail in rural Alaska. And so we really feel it's important that there be, you know, immediate and within 24 hours, you know, probably the closest thing to immediate, we could put in a bill effort to make sure people are informed about how to cure their ballot. We would also anticipate, since one of the duties of the rural community liaison is to facilitate access to absentee voting, which would be the ballots that would be being cured through the process, we would expect one of the duties that position would be doing would be working with communities and tribes to make sure there's local resources available to help, you know, if voters need a printer to cure their ballot, to make sure that people in communities are trained and available to help people cure their ballots.
One more question.
Sure, Representative Jimmy.
Co-Chair Foster. The tracking system and the fix your ballot process are tied together. Both have to happen or neither does. Why is this pairing important?
Mr. Densmore.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, this was a factor of the how this bill is a bipartisan compromise. The pairing of the two provisions sends the message that, you know, this bill is centered around both improving access to voting and ensuring that people's valid votes count while also having more election integrity safeguards like the tracking, which will allow voters to more easily verify the status of their absentee ballot.
Boyan.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I had, I guess, two quick follow-up questions. One of them had to do with the ballot curing question, Section 24. Previously, Ms. Beecher, I'd spoken with you about actual implementation of ballot curing and how we'd functionally do this process. We had quite a bit of a discussion about there would be an automated system that would help do the notifications with phone calls, emails, text messages, and potentially sending out the notice or sending out the paperwork that would be necessary to email. After hearing many of the questions that we've had on this committee and responses from the sponsor of the bill, is there still any concerns about the time differential listed in Section 24 about from when the notice would go out and when the department would have to send actual mail? Or is it pretty clear that you'd be able to develop a regulation that would meet the intent of the law?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have... The division has expressed concerns about these timeframes, particularly for individuals who may not be able to be contacted by phone, email, electronic means. The timeframe for receiving the by mail notice from the division and all of those things would have to be sent out to the voter. So it's the electronic, if we have the ability to do that, as well as by mail notification. The one of the big challenges of rural areas is the time frames that it takes to get mail of all over Alaska. It can be very long, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that Anchorage is the mail hub, essentially, and mail will go from Juneau to Anchorage to Ketchikan. And so it can take a long time based on the way that mail works in Alaska to get something. We're concerned about the 10-day time frame. The cured information required has to be back to the division within 10 days. If we mail something and it takes 5 days from when we mail it to get to the individual, are they going to be able to provide the information and get it back to the division in time for the cure to occur. That is one of our concerns for that time frame.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I have the same concern, but my concern really revolves around the idea of equal protections for rural voters versus urban voters. And I'm not exactly sure how we can remedy that other than you move up the time frame for all voters in which a ballot can be cured. But then again, you would also be restricting the amount of ballots that could be cured within that 10-day window. So I'm, you know, one of the things that had been mentioned to me was, is that we just need to have better encouragement for voters that are voting by absentee ballot, that they would request their ballots sooner and make sure they're filling them out and getting them in sooner. Now, I don't know if that particular answer is the one that I particularly care for under an equal protections portion, but that's a legal question. Specifically, my question was also about Section A of that. Under Section 24, that first part of that was A, when we talk about the requirement for within 24 hours, you need to make an attempt to notify the voter, and that's by the multiple methods, telephone call, text message. And within 48 hours, but not less than or not later than 5 days, send a notice of the deficiency by first class mail. Now, my understanding from the sponsor of the bill was, is they were trying to give additional time because maybe you would get this notice on Saturday, and obviously mail doesn't potentially go out on Sunday. But is there any issues from the department's perspective about that 5-day lag of allowing you the opportunity to still get things out in the mail? Or do you feel like, based on what we've heard in the committee, that language saying that you could have up to 5 days would create a problem?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the problems remain that regardless of when the division sends out the notice by mail, that the time frame that it takes for the mail to arrive and then for the individual to get it back to us is very short. And we feel that in the rural areas, they would be much disadvantaged as compared to the urban areas where they could go down to the division and provide it, or they could mail something in Anchorage and it's going to get to us quickly. It's going to be a real challenge as we see it for our rural voters to be able to cure. If there were a ballot that was curable, that was received on election day, for example, in that batch, and then we reviewed it and looked at it and saw that it needed to be cured, anything after election day that comes in as an absentee ballot that has to be mailed and received back is going to be a challenge for us to get them in time to actually do the cure.
So, thank you, Co-Chair, for the follow-up. So from the division's perspective, and then maybe I would then go over to the sponsor of the bill, what is the recommended remedy? I mean, this is a timing issue, and I don't know that we can put anything in place for a ballot curing process that is going to be perfect no matter what we do. So I'm just trying to understand from the division's perspective, if you foresee this as a problem, do you have a suggested remedy?
Ms. Beecher?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the remedy would be that individuals who, if we were to make it fair across the board, I think it would have to be that these absentee ballots to be cured would have to be turned in earlier. There would be the argument, of course, that that's not fair for people to have to turn in their ballots earlier, but that way it would ensure that there was time within the mail system for those who don't have the electronic means to use the online systems to get the cure information back to us.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, you raise great points. And I've struggled with this and I've thought about this. How do you make this equal? Probably realistically, the only way you can make this completely equal for rural Alaska is to put a division of elections in every single precinct in the state, which is impossible. It would cost billions of dollars. So what do we do in that? What do we do in the alternative? Well, The first question I would suggest is, does this bill make things better? Absolutely. This bill makes things absolutely better for those in rural Alaska. It makes things better for those in the military. It makes things better for those in urban areas because they'll be able to cure simple mistakes that they make. That's number one. Some other things that we did, though, in this bill that I think will help alleviate some of your concerns. Number one, we allowed ballots to start being processed by the division 12 days before the election. We expanded the time that they can process ballots. So ballots will come in. They'll have more time to begin processing those. People will make mistakes. They'll catch those mistakes earlier. They'll send them notices earlier. So that's one thing. I would know also, and this is very important, if you live in rural Alaska, if you live in a remote part of Alaska, there's a box you can check on your absentee ballots, and the division will send you a ballot 45 days in advance. And so I think maybe part of the job of the rural liaison, quite frankly, is to encourage those in rural Alaska to vote earlier. That's number one. I would also think maybe part of the job is to encourage those all across the state, but particularly in rural Alaska, put your email down, put your cell phone down. So that if you do make a mistake, they can text you, they can contact you. A couple of things that we've done, we've added a provision that ballots can be cured electronically. So if the person does get a notice or they look online and they see their ballots been rejected for some reason, they do have the option, instead of waiting for the mail to come in, to have it cured electronically. So I think that's something that can be done. My thought would be on this is don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. This is not a perfect bill, but I think it does a lot of good for a lot of people of all political persuasions. And I think it's a big step forward. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. And one quick follow-up. You know, if I had my preference, I've been asked, like, what would be the one big thing you'd change in this bill? I know that I mentioned it last year. I've mentioned it this year. And obviously, I don't think we're going to be able to get to what I think would be one of the cures for a lot of the reason that we're doing ballot carrying and how you do it and other states are doing it is the signature verification system and getting rid of witness signatures and just validating signatures. And I think that a lot of our problems where we see deficient ballots coming in, those will likely go away. I don't think we're going to probably get there this time around. I would like us to see us go to a system like that. I think it is more secure. It puts a lot more confidence in it. It's something that Anchorage currently uses. So, but with that being said, I think that I think that there is this challenge where we are talking about how do we make this system better. And the period where we're talking about trying to get this, looking in at these ballots a little bit sooner, is something that I do appreciate being in the bill. So I think we got some challenges. Like you said, it's not going to necessarily be perfect. But I also think that it is a step in the right direction for us to try to make sure that we have voting accessibility to folks more broadly. And with the ballot curing, I lost my spot for a second there. But for the ballot curing, one of the questions that I did have is there was this question about the witness signature and being able to cure the ballot. And so after talking with the bill sponsor, reading the bill again, talking with the division, my understanding of the ballot curing for a ballot that does not have a witness signature isn't the fact that we're curing the witness. It's the fact that we are confirming that the person that cast the ballot is affirming that they cast the ballot. And they do that by going through the cure process, sending in their ID so that the division can validate that they are, in fact, the person that cast that ballot. Is that a correct understanding of how we would be doing the curing for the lack of a witness signature?
Senator Wilikowski. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bynum through the chair. When I originally proposed this bill, I've just gone through a number of iterations. We originally had witness signatures that were verified by a system. That's millions of dollars. And so at a time when the deficits we have, that was not something that fiscally I could get support for. So then we thought, well, let's just remove the witness requirement. There was pushback by that. There's concern among people in the community who believe that puts some kind of I don't want to say fear, but there's some kind of a thought that, well, at least you're requiring somebody to verify it, even though you don't verify the witness signature. And so so we left the witness signature provision in, but for ballot curing, if you forget to have the ballot witnessed on your absentee ballot,
then the way this would work is you would take a picture of your ID, actually, and you would include that in the ballot that you send back. It'll be the most secure ballots that are received, quite frankly, because you actually have the concern is, well, somebody's going to maybe grab pull a ballot out of somebody's mailbox or fraudulently vote. Here you actually have the witnesses, the voter's ID that you can verify. So we think these are the most secure ballots that you have in the entire election. And that's the process for curing the witness, lack of witness signature. I would just keep in mind, ballot curing, we're talking about 1,000 ballots roughly that need to be cured every election. It's not a huge amount. Witness signature, I think accounts for 570 or so. We're not talking about an enormous number, but it's disenfranchising many Alaskans. And so we believe this is an important component of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Co-Chair Foster, thank you for the indulgence to ask the questions. Those are most of my questions that I had. I'm sure that as I sleep on this tonight, I'll dream about different questions that'll come up. But I do appreciate the opportunity to ask the questions. And I do, Co-Chair Foster, believe that the division needs to do a better job of the design of their absentee ballots. I actually used an absentee ballot this last election, and I can tell you that although the instructions are there, it is not intuitive that step one, you do this, step two, you do this, step three, you do this, step four, you do this, step five, you put two stamps on, step one, stamp two. And so I can see how people in a rush to vote, I guess would be the right term, could misstep and have a ballot that would not be counted because of a misstep. So I appreciate the opportunity to ask the questions. And thank you, Ms. Beecher, for being here, Senator Wilikowski, and your staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go to the last question, and then we'll close it. Or we'll go to the last two questions, Representative Galvin, then Jimmy.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you, Ms. Beecher. I can only imagine how difficult these years have been getting through. And I know there were so many, lost bags of ballots, all sorts of things that have happened. And so I want to thank you for working together, all of you, to make this happen. I know when we hear 570 voters out of the hundreds of thousands that we have, it may not seem like much, but in Alaska, there have been multiple races that have been won or lost by less than 20 votes. So everyone does matter. Every single vote does matter, and I'm grateful for your work.
Okay, Representative Jimmy.
Guyana Co-Chair Foster. So this bill is a compromise. As a representative of one of the most rural, most Alaskan Native districts in the state, does this bill make things easier, better for your voters compared to what is the law, what the law says right now?
Senator Wilikowski, I'll answer that. I would say absolutely yes, through the chair, for a number of reasons. It makes ballots, it makes our elections more secure. It removes, we know that we have 106% more voters than we do eligible citizens in the state. So we think it cleans up the voter rolls, makes it more secure. It speeds up the process because that's been a concern that people have had. Particularly for rural Alaska, it provides a rural community liaison, as we mentioned, which the goal is to try to help, quite frankly, open precincts that haven't been opened. It's a travesty that we have numerous precincts across the state during election years that just don't open, and those people are unable to vote. It helps postage paid envelopes, which we think, I know I talked to you and you mentioned that you had a couple post offices in your district that you went to recently that didn't have stamps. And so we think it'll help in that regard. And then ballot curing, people make mistakes, and this is not a partisan issue. I think there's actually more Republican votes that have errors than Democratic votes. This is not a partisan issue. There's just as many or huge numbers of military voters who are disenfranchised because they make mistakes as there are rural Alaskan voters. So there are mistakes. People make mistakes. We're human. And so the goal is we don't want to disenfranchise anybody. We want to make it easier. And I think this bill does that. It's not nearly as what I'd like it to be, but it's a compromise. And I think it moves our state forward and helps stop people from being disenfranchised. Thank you.
Last question.
Representative Jimmy.
Oh, yeah, no. Co-Chair Foster. Is there anything in this bill that makes it harder for a qualified rural Alaskan voter to cast a ballot and to have it counted?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I certainly don't believe so. That's not our intention at all. I will say, and in speaking with you and in speaking with rural legislators and those who are involved in ensuring that those in rural Alaska are able to vote, it does remove the provision that you can provide a fishing and hunting license, but it adds a tribal ID instead. And so that's a trade-off. But again, that goes towards the ballot security. My understanding in speaking with you and in speaking with many others is that most certainly Native Alaskans who live have a tribal ID. And so the hope is that they'll be able to provide that. They certainly can use other forms of identification when they go to the polling place as well. We do not believe this, and it's certainly not the intention of this, to make it harder for anybody to vote.
Anna.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Just a reminder, the amendment deadline for this bill is going to be Thursday, March 19th at noon. We're going to set this bill aside for now, and also we will not be getting to the other bill that we had intended to take up today. That is the House Bill 280, Highly Digitized Tax Bill. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning, March 17th at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll be reviewing the governor's next batch of amendments for the operating budget. And we'll be taking up House Bill 52, that's minors in psychiatric hospitals. So if there is nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:49 p.m. Thank you.